From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll get you ready for tomorrow's partisan primary election, and we'll look at where things stand in the presidential race in Wisconsin.
3 months is an eternity in politics, so we've got a ways to go. There are lots of twists and turns. Who has the momentum? Who has the energy? Who has the infrastructure? And how do the finances go?
The Milwaukee police chief addresses a shooting by out-of-state police officers during the RNC that left a man dead.
This is an event of the magnitude I don't think that our city has ever seen before. The expectation that there is perfection, I think, is a illogical and not rational belief.
Plus, we'll share some state park recommendations, including our very first to be founded. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, August 13th, is primary election day here in Wisconsin. There are partisan primaries for Wisconsin Assembly and Senate, and two constitutional amendments on the ballot. WUWM's voter guide has the information you need for this election. Joining us to talk about it is editor and project manager Emily Files. Hey, Emily.
Hi, Audrey. Thanks for having me.
So our listeners might have heard us talk about our voter guide before, but can you give us a rundown of what it is and how it can help people ahead of tomorrow's election?
Yeah, so a lot of times in elections, people have a hard time finding basic information about the candidates on their ballot, or maybe there are ballot questions that they're voting on that are worded in a complicated way and they're trying to figure out what they mean. So we try to provide information on things like that. Of course, we all know who's running in high-profile races like the presidential election, but there are so many down-ballot races that there's just not that much local information about. So ahead of each election, our voter guide looks at what those are and how we can fill in those information gaps.
Right. So what are the offices people will be voting for in this election?
So every 2 years, there's an election for all 99 seats in the Wisconsin Assembly and half of the 33 Senate seats. And this is one of those years. So there are a ton of legislative candidates up for election. Basically, anywhere you live in Wisconsin, you'll be voting at least for your assembly member, potentially for your senator. And this election is actually the first one under new legislative maps, which makes it even more interesting. So the previous maps were heavily gerrymandered to give Republicans a majority in the state legislature. And after years of court battles, those maps were thrown out. And now Wisconsin has more balanced maps, which means Democrats for the first time have a shot at winning a majority in the assembly. And it also means certain legislators were shuffled around to new districts. So your district lines might have changed and the candidates that you're voting for might have changed too.
Right. That's important for people to double check. And how will tomorrow's primary election factor into that?
So in some of the legislative races, there are multiple Democrats or multiple Republicans running. So voters will choose which Democrat or Republican they want on the ticket in November.
What are some of the interesting primary elections around Milwaukee that you've been looking at?
So looking for districts where there are Democrats or Republicans facing off, in Milwaukee on the east side and northern Bayview, there's an interesting race between Ryan Clancy, who's the incumbent for Assembly District 19. He's a Democratic socialist, and he's been farther to the left on some issues than other Democrats. And he has a more moderate Democrat challenging him named Jared Anderson. And Anderson has been endorsed by some high-profile figures like Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson and Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley.
That's interesting. A battle of the Democrats. We don't really get that too often.
Yeah.
Are there any districts with, on the other side, Republican face-offs?
Yeah, so if you look at the Menominee Falls and Germantown area, Assembly District 24, Representative Janelle Brantgen and Senator Dan Knodel are both running for that seat. They're both Republicans. Brantgen is further right than Knodel, and so this is a bit of a test to see what kind of Republican that district wants to represent them.
So what if people aren't sure about which Assembly or Senate district that they're in?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know which Assembly and Senate district I was in until I started looking at this guide. So we have a tool for that comes to us courtesy of John Johnson at Marquette University. He built a couple interactive maps, so you can look at the map and zoom into the area where you live, and you'll be able to see the Assembly or Senate district that you're in. And again, we don't have all of the Senate districts up, so the map just has some sections that have races in them. Then for every district in Southeast Wisconsin, we have candidate information that you can see. So if you're Assembly District 21, you zoom into where you live, click on Assembly District 21, you'll see what candidates are running, what party they're with, and what their priorities are.
Very cool. And is there anything else you want to share about the voter guide or the upcoming election? We will have a lot more reporting to come, but any highlights or previews you want to share today?
Yeah, so with tomorrow's election, there are a couple constitutional amendment ballot questions that Wisconsinites will be voting on, and the language is pretty confusing, and these constitutional amendments would have far-reaching implications for the balance of power in Wisconsin. So we have an explainer on those amendments on our website, so voters might find that helpful as well. And then, of course, you know, tomorrow's election is
just a warm
important, up. But the big one is November 5th, the presidential election. And then that's, you know, when all these legislative races will be decided as well. So stay tuned for the voter guide. We're cooking up for that one.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Emily. She is the editor here at WWM, joining me to talk about our online voter guide at WUWM.com.
Thanks.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. It's fewer than 90 days out from the presidential election, with another primary waiting in the wings tomorrow. J.R. Ross fills us in. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we've got a partisan primary tomorrow. It's expected to be relatively low turnout compared to November, but there's two constitutional amendments on the ballot about how Wisconsin's governor is able to allocate funds. They were added there by Republican lawmakers who didn't like how Democratic Governor Tony Evers spent federal COVID relief money. What can you tell us about that?
Well, from the big perspective, we're seeing a lot of money being spent by the groups opposed to the amendments. I went through finance reports last week. I found about $3.5 million raised by the three main groups so far. Now, the one group that's registered for the amendments had raised like $15,000. Doesn't count, though, like issue ads. Those are a different organization efforts. We've seen something from two conservative groups that are doing a six-figure buy, trying to push the amendment. Even with that, we're seeing a lot of money being spent opposing the amendment, and there's a good reason why. I mean, one, Democrats are opposed to it because they think it's an infringement upon Governor's powers, or Republicans trying to take away Evers' powers. But two, we're seeing Republicans more frequently go to referendum to try and pass things because Evers vetoes them. And I'm picking up this kind of thought from some Democrats that, hey, if they can knock down this effort on the referendum, maybe it'll discourage Republicans from going to referendum so often, trying to amend the Constitution over what are basically legislative disputes. So that's part of what's driving some of this. Now, looking at those amendments of language, it'll be interesting to see how voters perceive them. There are two questions. One seems a little more easier to read than the other, basically, but they're both basically about should lawmakers have say in how federal money is spent. That's been interesting. The ads against those amendments have really pushed the idea that these are trying to take away a check and balance. And Republicans are trying very hard to counter that. They're just being drowned out a bit by the paid campaign by the Democratic groups.
Where's the forethought in these types of constitutional amendments? I mean, it's possible that one day there will be a Republican governor and a democratically led legislature.
Oh, yeah. And Republicans make the argument that, look, we learned our lesson. We gave away this power back in the 1930s. It's time for a change. And after going through the COVID-19 experience where Governor Evers had basically sole authority to spend more than $5 billion, they don't want that to happen again. The counter has been that, look, you know, in emergency situations, if you have more reviews, you slow down things. And don't forget, if you go back to the COVID-19 pandemic funds and what happened with that process, Evers and Republicans did not agree at all on how to spend that money, at least not after the initial surge. Now, there was some kind of unanimity there in mid-2020 about how to do this. But after the next big batch of funds came under the Biden administration, it became a legislative slugfest. Republicans wanted to pass tax cuts and do all kinds of that money. And Evers said no, and he vetoed the bills they sent him. So, you know, it's just basically been they couldn't agree on anything, which is basically how they've operated for the last 5 years.
And do you know how this COVID relief money affected the average voter? Like, how would somebody know, you know, this is what I want the governor to be able to do with this kind of money, and this is what he did versus what Republican lawmakers are saying we don't want the money used for?
Oh, it's a good question, but it's a hypothetical one. You can't really, people aren't going to feel what they didn't experience, right? So you can say that, hey, Republicans wanted to pass tax cuts with that money, but they didn't feel that tax cut. So I'm not sure I can really quantify that for you.
Well, what did Governor Evers spend the federal COVID relief money on?
Oh, I mean, he spent it. There's, you know, medical emergencies. There were aid to various entities. He put money toward child care costs. But he's also put money toward things like, you know, funding sports facilities, helping with local developments, things like that, that Republicans said is not what this intended for, and that he's abusing the power, essentially. There's a breakdown the governor's office provides to the Department of Treasury every year, I think it is, on where it's gone. And, you know, most has gone toward helping small businesses bounce back from the COVID-19 pandemic, things like that. But there's definitely been some things that Republicans have said, hey, that's an appropriate expense for that money.
So people in various districts in this partisan primary tomorrow will either vote in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary. Is there anything on the ballot you're watching for around the state?
Well, it's going to be interesting, like, who's going to turn out, right? Because we only have the amendments on the ballot as a statewide question. You know, going back 2 years ago in 2022, we had a Republican primary for governor that helped boost turnout to about 27%. You kind of look through the years in 2020, it was 21%, 2018, 23, we had a primary for governor that year on the Democratic side. But in 16 and 14, we had turnout in the like 14.5% range. So we're not expecting a ton of people to turn out. There are some pockets of things, though, that are going to be interesting up in Green Bay. 8th Congressional District, there's a three-way GOP primary to succeed Mike Gallagher, who resigned from that seat. Tony Weed is a businessman who's been endorsed by Donald Trump. He's playing that up in his campaign ads. Roger Roth is a former state senator, ran for lieutenant governor in 2022. He's raised more money from others than Andre Jacques, who is a current state senator from De Pere, running as well. But, you know, Trump has been knocking Roger Roth as kind of like a rhino, quote unquote, which is interesting because Roger's a pretty loyal Republican while he's in the legislature. But still, and that's part of the knock on him. And then Andre Jacques has been kind of trailing financially, but he kind of put this ad together of him in a boxing robe, throwing shadow punches and, you know, being the big guy with the big right hook for conservatives kind of thing. It's kind of a kitschy ad, but might break through for somebody who's underfunded. So that's going to be interesting to watch. Over in Western Wisconsin, the 3rd Congressional District, we have a three-way Democratic primary to take on Derek Van Orden, a freshman Republican congressman from Prairie du Chien. That one's kind of come down to a slugfest between Rebecca Cook, who's a nonprofit director from Eau Claire, and Katrina Shanklin, a state lawmaker from Stevens Point. It's really been interesting to watch where that one goes. Cook has had more resources, raised more money. Shanklin's had a little more union support. But you look at the 3rd Congressional District, it kind of runs from along the Mississippi River and then east, not quite into Madison, Dane County area. And then it has this kind of island that kind of goes up his arm at grabs Stevens Point. So Shanklin's from a different part of the district than where most of the people live. She's got to break through in places like Eau Claire and La Crosse, which is where the population centers are, and give her a better shot in that district.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Okay, J.R., thanks for that. Let's talk about developments in the presidential race in Wisconsin. So the Marquette poll shows the race between Harris and Trump as on a knife's edge, as pollster Charles Franklin put it, about 50-50 in the state and within the margin of error. But Democratic enthusiasm is way up from before. What are you watching from now on?
Well, one, is this a sugar high? So let's pull back and remember that this race has changed dramatically in the last 3 weeks, right? Went from Joe Biden being the nominee, refusing to step aside, to all of a sudden on July 21st, he announced he's not going to run anymore. Kamala Harris steps in, visits Wisconsin a couple of days later. She becomes basically the presumptive nominee within days of that. Democrats embrace her. We were talking about an assassination attempt of Donald Trump like 3 or 4 weeks ago. That seems like an eon, a lifetime ago, right? Like things have changed so much in that race. So is this really truly Kamala Harris, like, you know, just getting a boost because she's not Joe Biden? Or is this some like a, how am I going to say this? When I've talked to Democrats, they have said that when Biden was still in the race, it felt like kind of a death march. Like they felt like they were going to lose this race and they couldn't do anything about it. They're trying to minimize the damage down ballot. Now that Harris is the nominee, there's this Democratic enthusiasm like, oh, this feels great. We have all this excitement and energy going on, and it's gotten to being tied. That's thing to remember. Like, as much as things have gone well for Kamala Harris lately, she's basically tied with Trump. The big thing is the enthusiasm has increased for Democrats. It gives them a shot. It doesn't mean they're going to win all of a sudden or that they have an easy path to victory in November, Wisconsin. It's still going to be a 50-50 state. That's what we are. But Democrats feel so much better because they feel like they have energy again, whereas with Biden, they felt like they'd kind of been sapped at energy because they felt like he wasn't going to win.
I looked up the Marquette poll from August of 2020, and it was showing Biden having a lead over Trump. And, of course, that race ended up being extremely close by just around 20,000 votes. You know, now the polls are showing it even closer. What would be the ways that people can pull ahead?
Well, you know, what's going to happen in the next 90 days with the economy, right? We had a rough day in the market last week, all kinds of attention for that for Republicans. Then the market kind of picked back up a couple of days later. Now it has recovered everything that lost, right? But there's one thing. We're going to see the Feds probably do an interest rate cut in September. I say probably because I'm not an economist nor a guy who does predictions very often, but the going thought is there'll probably be an interest rate cut. That could goose the economy. But if the things go south in a recession, that's not great for Democrats. They're in the White House right now. There's that issue. There's, you know, the examination of Tim Walz and J.D. Vance as running mates. You know, how's that going? Are they going to have any problems? Are they going to hinder the campaigns? It's just so many factors between now and November. I mean, again, we're talking about an assassination attempt a month ago, and Republicans are like, okay, this race is over. Donald Trump survived that. Joe Biden is a really weak incumbent. We're going to win. Now, everything's kind of back to 50-50. It's like I said, I always tell people 3 months is an eternity in politics. So we've got a ways to go. There'll be lots of twists and turns. Who has the momentum? Who has the energy? Who has the infrastructure? And how do the finances go? There are all kinds of factors like that, but that they can kind of work on. The things they can't control, like what happens with the economy? Is there going to be any kind of like global conflict? Those things that could really turn this race on a dime very quickly.
And, of course, we've talked in the past about how the Democratic Party in Wisconsin has been outraising the Republican Party and about how Biden, now Harris's campaign, had built out a lot more infrastructure in the state in the form of field offices and staff than the Trump campaign. Where are we at? Any idea now in terms of fundraising and infrastructure?
So we saw a big boost for Kamala Harris after she became the nominee. They outraised Trump in the last month. So they're very happy about that. Looking at Wisconsin, we have seen Democrats build 2 to 3 times more offices in the state than Republicans. But I also remind people that back in 2016, Trump in Wisconsin without much of an infrastructure, there was a lot of talk back then about how he really hadn't focused on that. So I don't know if that's the end-all be-all because Trump supporters are pretty diehard people when it comes to voting. I looked at the Marquette poll. We saw Democrats, 81% now are enthusiastic to vote in November. It's 86% for Republicans. So Democrats had a huge boost, you know, like 17 points, something like that. But Republicans still had an advantage. So there are lots of things out there that I'm kind of watching with this race. But The infrastructure piece is definitely in favor of Democrats. But does Donald Trump need that after what he's done before?
Okay, thanks for that breakdown, JR. Shifting gears a tiny bit, inquiring minds want to know, we've got the Olympics in Paris, France right now. Are you catching any of the events? And if so, what's your favorite?
I don't watch a lot of TV. I'm too busy going through finance reports.
Gotcha. So no track. No track, no swimming.
I catch 30 seconds every once in a while on social media what happened in an event. I did watch one swim race. I was walking the treadmill at the gym the other day. So I guess I got that going for me, but not a whole lot of Olympic watching. My family are big fans. Me, not so much.
All politics, all the time for JR.
Pretty much.
Well, thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Hey, anytime. Take care.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics. He speaks with WUWM's Mayon Silver for Capital Notes every other Monday. You can hear that here on Lake Effect and at WUWM.com. In about 20 minutes, we'll highlight some of the best state parks Wisconsin has to offer. But first, the Milwaukee police chief talks about how policing went during the Republican National Convention, including the shooting death of a Milwaukee man by out-of-state police officers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Last month, the Republican National Convention took over downtown Milwaukee for 4 days. The convention brought tens of thousands of people to the city, including thousands of out-of-state law enforcement officers to help local police with security. Columbus, Ohio police officers who were in town for the RNC shot and killed a Milwaukee man about a mile away from the convention. The shooting sparked community protests and calls for answers from the MPD. WUWM's Eddie Morales sat down with Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman to talk about what happened and evaluate how law enforcement did during the RNC.
Following up on our last chat just before the RNC, how are you feeling now that it's over?
Relieved. Go give you one more question, you won't get one more answer.
How would you grade the experience overall?
I would say a passing grade. It's important to understand that we always have learning lessons from any large particular event. But from the ability to collaborate with not only the event organizers, our elected officials, our various partners, passing grade.
Do you have an estimate for the total number of law enforcement officers that work the RNC?
We had thousands.
And would you say that number was a good number to have for the event, for the scale of the event, for the activity around the event? Was that a good number?
You know, it's hard to always, you know, look at what is the right amount, especially that I believe we had a number of engagements to help attenuate or reduce any particular type of challenges. But it's better to have and not need than need and not have.
Some out-of-state police were assigned patrol routes outside the RNC perimeter. How were those areas assigned?
Well, first of all, again, we don't get into the whole operation aspect of it. We know that there was some challenges in regards to their responsibilities, but they were not outside of the perimeter from the standpoint of our overall security footprint. I know that there was a number of different understandings of what that particular type of responsibility entails. But as we recall, you know, we had an inner perimeter, outer perimeter. And within that particular space, there was still the responsibility of, again, having a awareness of those particular points where we had vehicle checkpoints, and it's not just about being there, right, in the particular area. We had that covered, but also in regards to having the larger responsibilities of making sure that we were aware of any particular type of challenges or issues that were coming that particular way.
On July 16th, which was the second day of the RNC, officers from Columbus, Ohio, shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. near 17th and Valete. The body cam footage shows that Sharp held two knives as he approached another man in the street. The officers ordered Sharp to drop the knives. He didn't. Officers then opened fire when he lunged toward the man. How do you think local law enforcement would have handled the situation since they had knowledge of the locals and some of that area's unhoused population?
So I don't do Monday night quarterbacking. I look at what was the situation that was unfolding, the immediate danger. Those particular situations is a really hard way to navigate for law enforcement. As we all know, we are, have the responsibility of, being guardians in our community, to ensure that we're protecting everyone. What concerns me in this conversation is, what about the individual who is on the receiving end of that particular action? It seems like there's more focus on someone who is bringing immediate danger and threat in the way of great bodily harm, maybe to the point of death. But we are focusing on what was, again, the intervention of that particular behavior, and almost to a point, forgetting that someone was going to be on the receiving end of those particular behaviors. We have a responsibility to protect our community, and I challenge in regards to the question about whether this was a outside agency. That particular patch could have been a Glendale, could have been a West Allis, could have been a squad coming from our community partners, coming through the neighborhood, going to the county justice facility downtown, which serves Milwaukee County. I don't understand the focus on the particular agency and not on the behaviors and the, requirement to protect life and liberty. And so as I look at this particular situation, I would like to say, what would have happened if they weren't there? What would have happened if they would have said, well, we're from Ohio. This is not my responsibility. It is a challenge, I guess, in this situation that, yes, there was unfortunate intervention where, someone had a loss of life, which I've said this on many occasions. There are no winners in this, but I still want to refocus the conversation on the behaviors, the immediate danger that was involved, and that this was a split seconds of decisions being made that, had... It required response.
Did out-of-state officers receive any area-specific training?
There was discussions in regards to responsibilities, expectations. So there was a briefing in regards to that particular work. This is not where we discuss our operations, but we understood the need to make sure that we were putting enough work into our outside response agencies to know the resources, points of contact, and responsibilities.
The officers from Columbus were not paired with Milwaukee officers, but was that something that was considered during preparation? Is that something that you would push for in preparation for another large-scale event, to have out-of-state officers be paired with local law enforcement?
So again, interesting conversation. As we know, these things come every 4 years, and there's no need to have a discussion about what might be in the future, for we already know the RNC is going to be in Houston. Looking at what we did, there's always, the responsibility to ensure that we are improving, as was pointed out in the response to some of the questions earlier posed to us from our media. We did recognize the need to ensure that there was that type of having the outside agencies have partners with a local officer. This is an event of the magnitude I don't think that our city has ever seen before. The expectation that there is perfection, I think, is a illogical and not rational belief. We put forth effort, and as I've shown in regards to the leadership for this department, confidence, does not equal perfection. Confident we have plans, but as we all know, plans have to be reviewed. If there is a situation you need to, again, put forth some redirection or looking at how we can improve, we should always be open to that. And we put forth the effort over a year and a half of effort to, you know, put forth the best plans that we had with very little experience before, especially that the DNC was mostly virtual, of knowing that this was an extremely huge lift, that, you know, putting in efforts that we may never see this particular type of level of, you know, a national special security event ever again in this city, maybe not in my professional lifetime.
What does covering the RNC, preparing for the RNC, and then the shooting that took place, what does that do with community relations between the police and the citizens? What is MPD doing now to maintain or improve those relations?
We continue to engage. This is a very interesting conversation in regards to, it's almost like we're picking and choosing who has a more right to live or how to die, or what is the importance in regards to officer response of being guardians. So we are missing the conversation about the, you know, potential victim here in this situation. So what was supposed to happen to him? He didn't have any knives in his hands. He was standing right in front of someone who was an immediate threat to his own life. Why are we not focusing on behaviors rather than there is no theme or particular words or actions that were shown what we would not expect about sworn officers here to protect life and liberty? There was an immediate threat to great bodily harm or death to the person who was at the receiving end of whatever conflict or, you know, issue that happened between the two of them. That is, again, perplexing to me in regards to how do we lose faith in law enforcement when you have a situation, like I always say, a sworn officer needs to respond. So when we talk about this particular situation, does it make a difference if it's Ohio? What if it would have been Wauwatosa? Would it have made a difference in regards to what law enforcement responded when you have someone who is in our community about to receive harm?
In a situation where officers are seeing this unfold in front of them, mm-hmm. are there techniques to kind of de-escalate things? Is that something that is trained?
Key words there. If. De-escalation has its proper place when there is cooperation in regards to the work or actions being shown. De-escalation is trained for our entire department. We have it, but it's a tool of one of many things that we utilize in regards to dealing with volatile or serious situations. But you talk about this situation. This is a very specific situation that unfolded very, very quickly. De-escalation is the opportunity when the opportunity arises. You just said yourself, he was lunging. Where is the de-escalation to do or deal with that? De-escalation is for the purpose of slowing things down. Did it seem slow to you? Did it seem slow to anyone? And so as we discuss this, again, I'm perplexed in this conversation because the focus is on a threat where there was someone receiving into that threat. So that person doesn't have a right to live. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, we all know the challenges in regards to the unhoused and dealing with those who have mental health challenges. But when you have behaviors like that, this is not just a, you know, simple field investigation or an investigation of a more common nature. We had a in-the-moment action going on with very few little options. I saw it from my own professional perspective. The officers had only two choices, one to engage or two to ignore. I don't believe our public, I don't believe our city would have found that to be acceptable if they did not engage. I find that there would have been a lot more angst and frustration and maybe even a narrative that typical officers don't care. Here you had officers, in light of the challenges of not being from our community, understanding the role of what a guardian should be, engaged to protect someone's life. That's the narrative I choose to talk about.
overall, what are some lessons learned from the preparation for the RNC for covering an event of that scale? Do you have any takeaways?
I'm glad it's over. You know, when you try to do a little bit of a post look at, you know, the particular training and the planning, I can't be more proud of the team that we had for planning purposes. We had to take a number of members offline just to do this work solely for almost, you know, a little over a year and a half. And it just, you know, again, want to reiterate that as much as you plan, you think you have enough plans. I mean, I've met with the team, you know, on a frequent basis. We had a lot of difficult, tough questions in regards to, you know, what resources we bring in, how we're going to utilize. Reflection, I wouldn't have changed anything in regards to how we had really engaged, especially from our executive leadership to our, you know, planning team. I mean, once we got close to the actual event, we were meeting weekly, which is a huge commitment from our executive team with our planning team that, you know, we're doing it on a daily basis, you know, many, many hours, working with so many partners. You know, I did a lot of traveling to recruit, going to different communities, going to different, you know, departments and chiefs. You got to put the work in. And we put a lot of, you know, professional hours into this. For what we have had to deal with from a post-2020, a post-DNC virtual where we didn't have a true experience of what these challenges were like, I believe that, again, you asked me for a grade. We got a passing grade from the standpoint that, you know, with all the challenges of staffing, you know, I had to use a lot of professional capital to bring resources into the city because of the challenges of what it is policing in the 21st century. And so I will say that, you know, proud of the team, proud of the work, and absolutely proud of our city in regards to that. Beyond just a couple of those, you know, challenging situations, we really did shine. And the majority, not just some, but the majority of talk was about the event and the beauty of our city.
Jeffrey Norman is the Chief of Police for the Milwaukee Police Department. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. We'll take one more break, and then when we come back, we'll share some recommendations for Wisconsin state parks. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. From the Driftless region to the North Woods to the Door County Peninsula, the Wisconsin State Park System encompasses 50 state parks. The DNR manages 1.2 million acres of recreation areas as a part of this system, including state forests, state trails, and over 6,000 campsites. With so much to explore, where do you even start? Well, for recommendations, freelance writer Allie Waters has plenty of suggestions to help you start planning. She joins me now to share more. There are 50 Wisconsin state parks, so how many have you personally traveled to so far, and how did you get into the outdoors and all the activities that this can encompass?
I have always had a love for the state parks. I write about it a little bit in our package. for Milwaukee Magazine. And as a child, my family, we all used to kind of pile into our minivans and we would go to different destinations around Wisconsin. And some of the ones that I really have a fond memory for are going to like Devil's Lake State Park. And we went to the Elroy Sparta Trail. We went to the Peninsula State Park. And that was kind of my first introduction to it, was doing these family camping trips, hiking around the town, playing with my cousins. I have now been to 20 state parks, and I would love to get to them all over the course of my lifetime. But it's hard because I keep returning to so many of my favorites. But I try to squeeze in a few new ones each year.
Well, I totally understand going back to the favorites, and your core memories are right along the line with my family camping trips. So whether people are exploring new parks or going back to old favorites, there truly is something for everyone, including those looking for different kinds of geography. So can you explain a bit of like the variety that people have access to within our state?
Yeah, so in the package, I broke this up in all sorts of different ways. We have the ones that are close to home. We have a section called The Bluffs Are Calling, which is all about our rocky geological state parks that have these interesting bluffs that you can climb to the top of and get these remarkable overlooks, often of the Mississippi River. We have parks that feature waterfalls that are absolutely stunning, and we kind of get into the different kinds of waterfalls we get, the really tall, skinny ones, the short, wide ones that you can walk right up to. We have parks that are along what we call the Fresh Coast. That's like Michigan. So we get to see these like massive sweeping views and these picturesque beaches. But then we also have a section, we call it Lakes That Are Still Pretty Great, which is all about our inland lakes. And then, of course, there's rivers, there's woodsy parks, and we also have a section all about the parks that are for the history books, the ones that feature a lot of our state heritage and where we came from before.
So many great things and, you know, lots to choose from with 50, right? But I want to start with what's close to home, which you categorize as just within 1 hour's drive of Milwaukee, which is great. And let's start with Harrington Beach. And I will say I went there a ton during COVID, even if it was just for a little day walk.
Well, that's a great thing is anyone who lives in the state of Wisconsin is probably pretty close to at least one state park that they can get to. More likely, they're close to a few. And so Harrington Beach is this great state park. It's on the sandy stretch of Lake Michigan, but it also has this really unique history to it. It preserves this old historic Wisconsin quarry town. So there's this big, like crystal clear quarry lake that you can walk around and you can peer into this 45-foot pit because the water is so clear and get a good look at it.
Yeah, and lots of good camping sites as well that are kind of more in the prairie land if you want it, or you can hear the lake even too. So Harrington's a great place to start. And if people want to take a trip just a bit further up 43 North, there's Kohler Andre State Park.
Kohler Andre is fantastic. It's actually my most recent state park, the newest one that I've seen. I visited it while I was writing this package. And what's so cool about it is it's actually two parks, kind of for the price of one. The park combines Terry Andre and John Michael Kohler State Park. And the big draw to this park is that it has a cord walk, which is a lot like a boardwalk, except instead of walking over water, you're walking over sand. And you get to see these really delicate sand dunes and how beautiful they are. The last time I was there, I saw sandhill cranes, but a lot of people get really excited because they get to see deer prancing around the dunes.
Certainly a very picturesque park. Up next for within an hour of Milwaukee is Aztalan State Park.
Aztalan it's a super important archaeological site for the state of Wisconsin. It preserves this ancient late woodland Native American village that was around roughly between the 11th and 13th centuries. So that is just super old. In 1919, they did this massive excavation of the area and uncovered a lot of the original settlement. So when you're there, you go into the visitor center and you can get this trail guide that will show you the history of this park, and you can walk around and do your own little self-guided tour, which is very cool.
I mean, there's so much history in a lot of the parks that you wrote about. It's something I hadn't considered and reasons to pick a new park, but I love that. And we're going to go outside of our little hour outside of Milwaukee path here, and we're going to go over a few of what are off the beaten path. And since COVID, camping obviously has gotten very popular, even into what we typically see as the off season. But you spoke with an expert to find some lesser known features, right?
Yeah, so I love our off the beaten path section because what it does is it takes our three most popular state parks, Devil's Lake State Park, Peninsula State Park, and Governor Dodge State Park. Those are the parks that draw the most visitors. And we talked to an expert within the Wisconsin DNR, Sarah Bernaski, and I asked her, if you're going to these big parks and you want to kind of skirt the crowds, where should you go? And she gave us some great advice. So for Devil's Lake State Park, she talks about the fact that they just added a new trail there that is still a little lesser known that you can hit. At Peninsula State Park, she talks about the fact that they do these great theater shows within the park where you can go and catch a show. And these shows usually are about local connections. One of them is called The Fisherman's Daughter. And that one tells the story of two sisters in early Fish Creek who are dealing with what happens when the land that they live on gets turned into Peninsula State Park. And then Governor Dodge State Park, she offers up this great trail that actually leads you to a cave. And she makes a point to recommend that you should bring your flashlight so that you can see inside.
Yeah, a cave exploration sounds like a ton of fun and something different to do while you're hiking. And let's go to the Chain of Lakes area of Waupaca, Wisconsin, to Hartman Creek State Park next.
Yes, I remember the first time I went to Hartman Creek State Park. I had no idea what I was stepping into, and it has since become one of my absolute favorites. What it is it's part of the Chain of Lakes, which means these lakes, which are all spring-fed, are all interconnected. And so what you can do is you can rent a kayak or you can bring your own or a paddleboard or a canoe or whatever suits you. And you can basically do a little paddle trail through these different springs. And the real finale is if you end at Morrow Lake. This lake is an unbelievably, like almost surreal, crystal clear blue lake that when you see it, you'll realize how spectacular it is. And so after you've worked up your sweat from paddling, you can jump in and take a dip and you'll see tons of people just floating in their life preservers or swimming free and having a ton of fun taking a break from their boating.
I love the picture that you put there in my head. So we've been talking about a number of different state parks, but I want to give some love and a shout out to our first state park ever, and it's called Interstate Park. Can you share a bit more about the history there?
This was a really fun surprise to learn when I was writing about the state park feature, because the first thing that I thought to myself was, why do we have a state park system? Why is it so big? How did we get so much of this land protected? And one thing that I learned in the process is that Wisconsin was one of the very first states to even consider a setup like this. We started talking about the Wisconsin state park system really early on. In 1878, the Wisconsin legislature approved the protection of what was then called the state park, one of the first of its kind in the country. But it wasn't until 1900 that that really came to fruition. And the state park would eventually become Interstate State Park. And that also led to the founding of our Wisconsin state park system, which is such an incredible undertaking. We have so much protected land in our state.
That is really amazing and something we take for granted in our own backyard. And hopefully with this guide, it's a good starting point for people to get out, whether they're regular campers or just want to find something new in a day trip. But I want to end our conversation with one of your all-time favorite state parks, which is Rock Island. So why is this one of your tried and trues?
Rock Island State Park is just, it's like nothing you've ever done. So you go, everyone knows about Door County. People go to Peninsula State Park. But if you drive all the way to the tip of Door County, you have to go past that really famous curved road. You'll get to a dock and you'll have to take a car ferry over to Washington Island, which is another really beautiful island. If you go there, you should stop at the Lavender Fields. But you take your car, you go to another pier and you ditch your car and you get on a person ferry and you head to Rock Island State Park. Once you get to that island, there are no cars there. It's just people. You have to walk everywhere you go. You're likely going to camp there, but it's quiet like you've never heard, because when are you anywhere where there are no cars? And it's just super beautiful and spectacular. You can hike the whole park in a day, but it still feels remarkably big, but you get to experience the whole thing very well. It's a wonderful park. I highly recommend it.
I'll have to add that to my list. Well, Allie, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about some of the gems in our state park system.
All right. Thank you for having me, Audrey. It was great talking about them.
Allie Waters is a freelance writer for Milwaukee Magazine. We spoke earlier this summer. And that's Lake Effect for today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. For Lake Effect producer Excret Nunez, this has been her first summer living here in Milwaukee. And last week, she had her first Wisconsin State Fair experience. She'll share what that was like with you tomorrow on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.